So Merci to Jean-Marc, and thanks to Drew and everyone that's come tonight to help launch the media co-op. It's kind of the next evolution of indie media, so it's really great to be part of this and be part of a new institution that's growing. I've been asked to speak about media and resistance more generally, so if you want to talk about radio projects like CKT or Groundwire, our effort to build a national community news program, then meet me at this mixer. Maybe we can talk about it over a beer, because I'm going to speak more generally about media and resistance. And do it very fast, because I have 7 minutes. I want to mention, first off, that people have been writing about media and resistance for a really long time. Every time a new media technology comes out, people say it's going to revolutionize something. Everybody's seen the headlines lately that talk about social media and social movements and the so-called Twitter revolution and Facebook's revolutions. I know that a lot of us probably consider that bullshit, but we do know that media are tools, and tools that are used by activists and that actually impact resistance movements. And like I said, people have been writing about it. It's documented in this book about pirate radio in Canada called Islands of Resistance. And the book that's being raffled tonight, Autonomous Media, it's also documented there. It was published in 2005 by lots of different authors talking about lots of different mediums, radical mediums. There's also works that talk about revolution in print and the links between the printing press and the French Revolution. The French Revolution wouldn't have happened like it did if it hadn't been the printing press, not to mention all the people involved too. And then also books that talk about the link between small media and the Iranian Revolution, where cassette tapes and flyers and leaflets and all of these mediums in which we use as activists to engage and reach out to people on the streets and build our popular movements, all of those are medias, and those have been documented as useful to resistance movements. So just in terms of tonight, I wanted to speak to some of my experiences in indie media and then also at CKUT and kind of talk about some of the lessons I've learned and hopes that, you know, in building new institutions that we can bring some of those lessons to those projects as well. When I think about indie media, I think about how it linked me to my radio experience. Without indie media, I wouldn't have learned how to build radios. I wouldn't have learned how to set up antennas and solder transmitters. I wouldn't have had this great connection to all of these different media activists across the states and gone to all these different convergences and built media centers to cover protests. I wouldn't have had those experiences if it hadn't been for indie media and if I hadn't been living in Seattle in 1999. So all of that came together, and I had these experiences, and all along the way, there were contentious things that happened. All along the way, there were struggles within these media activist spaces where we were trying to support our local resistance movements and trying to build these convergencies and share the very small resources and do the work that we needed to do to help the local resistance movement. You know, and some of those challenges were things like the hierarchies that exist between people who are more experienced, maybe more professional, and people who are newcomers, people who have access to online technology or any kind of technology, and people who don't. All of those create challenges and dynamics between public spaces that you're trying to create as inclusive spaces, as grassroots spaces. So we have to constantly problematize these spaces, these grassroots spaces that we're building, the people that we're reaching out to, who's missing, who's not there, what kind of hierarchies exist in those places, the resources that are coming together, and who's using the resources, who's not using them, who's not online enough to send emails and check them regularly, and so on and so forth. Other issues that come up are also with regard to like the purpose of our work and the politics in our work. And being media activists, we're linked with resistance movements, and I know that for some media journalists, they might see that, you know, there has to be a distance between you and the thing that you care about, you know, if you're going to be a journalist and do the work that you need to do, if you're going to be ethical, if you're going to be balanced, if you're going to be fair, if you're going to be accurate, if you're going to be all those things that they say journalists has to be. But within our work as media activists, none of that comes into play, because it's often the other end of the stick that counts, right? It's like, how embedded are you in these movements? And those movements are often the embeddedness of people's involvement is what drives them and their participation in media. So in my experience at CKUT, when I first got there, one of the things that happened at the station was that it sort of perceived as like a clubhouse, a place where people could come and do their radio work and have fun. And people didn't really see the political importance of that, but that talk and that discussion had been happening before I got there. People wanted it to be a participatory space. People wanted it to be a place that could be radio that represented the voice of the voiceless. All of that discussion and conversation and fighting had happened before I even got there. What changed in the last 10 years that I worked at the station was that the technology changed a bit. We were able to start doing digital editing. So we're able to make radio learning a bit more accessible. It wasn't that analog editing where it's like long tape and you have to cut and it takes hours to produce. It became much more quicker. But even today, digital editing poses a challenge. Not everybody knows how to even save a file or knows what you mean by a folder. All of these things present challenges, and it shouldn't be assumed that just because we're in 2011, everybody knows how to use a computer. The other thing is that in terms of being a campus community radio station, we are a licensed station, unlike the stations that are in this book, which are unlicensed radio stations. But I think it's essential for media activists to take spaces where there are resources, like a 5,000-watt radio station that CKUT is, and transform that into a transgressive space, transform that into a radical space, and make sure it stays radical, and make sure the politics stay relevant, and not just become the politics of those who are included and not the politics of those who are excluded, right? Like, our alternative and resistance medias can also be exclusive, so we need to challenge that when that's happening, and we need to also constantly be outreaching and including those people who are excluded, misrepresented, or underrepresented in other medias. The ways in which CKUT I've seen successfully challenge the media form in the sense of having a goal to sort of take down the media system, right? Like, the goal at CKUT had previously been to train people to be part of the CBC, to train people to be part of the mainstream. Now I think we're training people to see that there's a new way of creating media, a new way of building media institutions, like the Media Co-op, trying to make something totally different. And at CKUT, I saw really good examples whenever we were doing, like, for example, the annual Homelessness Marathon. It's a broadcast that we do outside on the street with poor and homeless people, and we try to amplify their voices, but also include them in the process of organizing the marathon as much as possible as well. And in this whole process of setting up the marathon and producing it, we do it with no budget, very little budget, thanks to QPIRG's support for the discretionary funding that we get for that. But we also don't get a license to sit outside on the sidewalk. Like, usually if you want to set up shop on the sidewalk and do anything in your public space, you have to get some kind of, you know, agreement or permit from the city to do it. But we don't do that. We've never done that. And it's now been 10 years that we've been organizing the Homelessness Marathon. We've never been harassed by the cops, which is a good thing, because it would be live radio, you know, police brutality potentially on the air, and I don't think they want those problems. So maybe that's the reason why. So in addition to, you know, essentially breaking the law and broadcasting all night on the street corner of St. Laurent, Ontario, we've also done things like support Kader Abdelbalouni, who was an Algerian refugee that was in sanctuary for more than 3 years. We went there once a month and set up a broadcast in his space. Now, sanctuary is essentially a prison. Someone's in there and can't leave until the government of Canada decides, okay, are we going to deport this person or not? So Kader was essentially in prison, but for that 1 hour once a month, we were able to broadcast his voice at 5,000 watts, effectively liberating him. And that's why he called it the radio liberation, the hour of power, the hour in which he felt most free over this 3.5 years in which he lived in a room in a church. The other last example that I want to mention with regard to my experience at CKUT is a recent broadcast that we did last March for Abu Sufyan Abdelrazik, who is a Sudanese-Canadian who was being refused his passport while he was, like, in Sudan visiting his mom, who got sick, his passport expired, wanted to come back, and was stranded for, like, 6, 7, 8 years under two governments of liberals and conservatives, not getting his passport. You know, we did a broadcast here in CKUT after he had eventually been brought back by a grassroots movement who fought and fought for his return. He finally came back, and Canada was still oppressing this guy, saying, you can't get the money, you can't hire him, he's still a terrorist. His local community of support had a fundraiser for him, which basically meant they were putting out a toll-free number. They did the whole, like, call-in setup with the map for where donations are coming from. They were only trying to raise $1,267 to also symbolically represent the list, the 1267 terrorist list that he's on. So they were only trying to raise a little bit of money. It was a symbolic protest, but nonetheless, it was a protest that was requiring people to break the law. So CKUT went there and not only encouraged people to call into the broadcast and break the law, but we had hosts and programmers on the air saying, I'm going to go break the law. So in a sense, you know, we're amplifying breaking the law, popularizing breaking the law. We should be doing that more. Anyway, so use your license, unlicensed, whatever means you have to encourage people to break the law. I think it's a great lesson. But also just to radicalize those spaces. But know that there's lessons that should be brought from the previous experiences of indie media, from projects like Ababart, from other projects that exist locally. People have experiences of trying to grow these projects and the problems that they've come along on the way, and we can definitely talk more about that in the question and answer session, because I think I've probably talk beyond my time. So thank you, guys.
I hope, if don't offend anybody, if somebody done it already, but I want to acknowledge that we're in Mohawk land. I'm just going to give you an abbreviated... I'm sorry?
Tsiodaghe is what the Mohawk call this island.
Okay.
And the Huron call it Oshilaga.
Okay. Somebody warned me there will be some controversy about making that statement.
You're going to have controversy. It's a shared territory. Tsiodaghe.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you for that. And so I'm just going to give you like a abbreviated history of the Vancouver Media Co-op. But I also have to acknowledge that the Vancouver Media Co-op would have never gotten its start if it wouldn't have been for the great work that Drew does at getting the website done. So just big round of applause for Drew. We're constantly fucking bugging him to fix something or other. I just want to know that we appreciate it. So the Vancouver Media Co-op was radical from the get-go. And the reason I say that is because we started as the media arm of the Olympic Resistance Network. And so we were a subcommittee within the organizing of the anti-Olympic protest. And while going through all these meetings, one of the things that several of us brought up was that why the fuck are we going to build this independent media infrastructure for a single event and then the Olympics are over? And so the Vancouver Media Co-op, you know, the website was operational. And so we all decided, well, let's just, you know, become the Vancouver Media Co-op and let's just, you know, make a long-term independent media project that's radical in the city of Vancouver, since the Vancouver Indie Media website had been defunct for several years. And so the reason why that's radical, I'm sure a lot of people here are aware of what went down during the anti-Olympic protests. But the big slogans of the Olympics were "No Olympics on stolen native land," and on the posters it said "anti-colonialist" and "anti-capitalist." So that basically set the tone of how we were going to like sort of project our politics into the media co-op. So one of the first things that we had to do in order to have media co-op is have members. So we started having like big public meetings and basically attracting people and just telling them, just very much like this, like showing them the website, showing them how to publish, and then holding workshops. And the workshops were amazingly successful just because, one, they were free. So a lot of people who would never thought to create video would come and like learn, you know, a crash course on video production over a weekend. And then we would just throw them into the fire and say like, okay, just produce a video. It doesn't matter how crappy it is. Just do it and we'll publish it. And you'll see how good that feels. And another way we increase membership is by, you know, basically keeping our whole infrastructure open, you know, so we can tell people where and when the meetings were, and people could always like plug in that way. Throughout the year leading up to the Olympics, we basically remained active, not only in covering the anti-Olympic movement, but just because we were plugged into that, we will also cover a lot of anti-poverty actions, indigenous sovereignty, immigrants' rights actions. By the time the Olympics happened, we were, even though it was a whole lot of work, and I just couldn't believe it, that the day had actually come, we actually had a space. We hosted over 50 journalists from all over the world who came to basically plug into the Independent Media Center. We literally had like no budget. We were in the basement of this building in the downtown east side. It was freezing and cold in January, and it was hot in there. We actually had an air conditioning running, but we did have an internet connection. And we were essentially, in a sense, competing with social media outfits that were trying to capitalize on the fact that the Olympics were in town. And these were outfits that had taken money from the Olympics, that had big fancy spaces just down the street. And I'll be very happy to tell you that those spaces remained empty, and those spaces did not produce even like a tenth or even 5% of what was produced in the basement of, is it 16 Lira? I mean, 16 is Hastings. We were never rated. We have pretty good security, even though we sort of expected those raids to happen, because that space had a history of being raided. That's basically where the cops went when the Olympic flag was stolen. Yeah, and they raided that space. Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the corporate media sort of pointed to us as being like sort of the media for the Black Bloc, and even with that, like, we were able to keep our security tight. And I say, you know, we really kicked some ass. Our coverage was featured on Democracy Now twice, and we produced probably dozens and dozens of stories during the anti-Olympic convergence that continued past the convergence and into the tent city coverage. And so our big test was going to be, is the media co-op going to continue after the Olympics? And I was scared to death. Like, the Olympics are going to be done. Is the interest of the people going to continue? Are people just going to be completely fucking burned out that they're going to chill out and not continue on it? And I can say that we have consistently had over a dozen people in our core group, and the content in the Vancouver Media Co-op continues to be fresh every day. We actually compiled an anti-Olympic archive that covers the Olympic resistance movement from the Olympics all the way up to the very end, and we have recently started paying for stories. So we pay for one story every month, and we also offer people a stipend, travel stipend, if they want to cover, like, for instance, there's an ongoing blockade that's been going on and off in the Sinaix territory in eastern BC. We actually given people money to go and cover that story. So, you know, I'll just kind of wrap it up. With that said, you know, I'll just kind of come back to what I said before. We have basically strived to do stuff that's not really being done in Vancouver just because there's been a lack of radical media. And so we've been really, not necessarily vigilant, but we've been, like, pretty conscious about just keeping the content on the website like that, because otherwise, I mean, why are we going to become, like, another sort of, like, media arm of the NDP? Like, why is that useful, you know? We want to be, like, the place where radicals go to get their news, where grassroots activists can count that we are going to be their allies in media, and where people are going to feel comfortable in posting their opinion pieces, you know? And the last thing I'll say is that, you know, with being a radical media organization, just also be aware that the eyes of the law are going to be upon you. And a lot of our members got visits, including myself, from the police. But in a sense, you can also take that with you and say that, you know, if you're being visited by the police, that you're probably being effective. So thank you very much.
Merci à tous les gens qui ont parlé. Notre we'll have a short Q&A now, and then afterwards. Also, the idea was to do what we're calling—we've never tried before—a media mixer. That's why we're asking people to write their neighborhoods and topics on the paper on the wall over there. After the Q&A, we're going to try to do some small breakout groups based on neighborhoods, so people will have a chance to kind of meet people who live in the same area, if you feel comfortable, you know, doing that. Talking about, you know, issues and ideas that could be covered in those neighborhoods, and then we'll come back together. Drew will facilitate that and talk a bit more about it later, but just so people don't start rushing out. And I'll also pass this around. What's that?
And then we'll have
cake. There's chocolate cake, so stick around for the cake.